You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Test 1-2, rock and roll. It's Thursday, the 23rd of February 2006. I'm sitting at Cafe Panetta in South Melbourne with the man of the moment, Hugo Kelly. Journalist, raconteur, ratbag, larrikin. I think I heard you called a larrikin a few times in the last couple of weeks, Hugo.
These have been names that have thrown at me. Sticks and stones often stick, that's true. I call myself anything but late for breakfast.
Although you were late for our coffee this morning.
5 minutes, Cameron. Testing the tram system out.
Now, Hugo, you've been a journalist in the old world of journalism and in the new media world, writing for Australian, again, quote-unquote, larrikin media company, crikey.com.au, for the last 5 or 6 years. Thanks, mate. And you recently completed your employment with Crikey under rather public circumstances. But as I said to you before, we're not really here to talk about that. Although we can, I just don't want to open myself up to any libel or slander suits from your former employers. Because, you know, your former employers themselves have seen a bit of that over the years and know what that's like for a new media startup. But I'm really interested in your experience. How long have you been a journalist now, mate?
Coming up for 20 years.
You're a young-looking fellow. You only look like you're in your late 20s, mate.
Aren't you nice? Started at the age in the ancient regime when I was 17. Back when they gave cadetships to young, bright-looking kids out of school.
That's how Charles Wright started about 55 years ago, I believe, too.
Yeah, I think he was in the 1857 intake.
Yeah, yeah.
And Charlie's gone on to he's a bit like me, Charles. He's started in the hot metal days, and he's straddled the birth of the internet. And I guess back then the Age was pretty much the duck's nuts. It was a great newspaper back in Melbourne. It was a fantastic education to learn the nuts and bolts of daily journalism in a newspaper that still had plenty of clout and still had some great writers and an ethic to serve the city and to serve the state. So you were proud to go to work every day. And I guess that's something that I enjoyed also about Crikey in a sort of inverse way, going to helping start a kind of a mini-revolutionary little publication that put noses out of joint and started a bit of debate.
So take people back. For our international... We have a lot of international listeners on this show. Crikey was a... Did it start off as a newsletter or did it start off as a website?
Crikey started off as a... as a political campaign that turned into an internet site. Stephen Mayne and I were old colleagues at the Age. We took slightly divergent paths after leaving newspapers. Stephen went to work for Jeff Kennett.
Premier of Victoria? Or was he opposition leader at the time?
He was Premier at the time.
Yep.
And was a spin doctor for Kennett and his in his glory days when he took over Victoria in 1992 and ran the state as his own personal fiefdom, for good and for ill. They were tremendous times. Meanwhile, I went off to work for the Labor Party in the federal sphere. And both of us found ourselves at the end of the millennium scratching our heads and wondering what to do next. We'd done politics, we'd done journalism, and Stephen had a burning desire. He had a road to Damascus experience and realised that what all he'd done for Jeff hadn't been quite good and all Jeff had done for Victoria hadn't been quite wonderful. There was a little bit of corruption going on, and Stephen felt the need to challenge Kennett.
Allegedly, a little bit of corruption going on, which I'd like to point out.
Certainly alleged, and I wouldn't want to engender any writs, Cameron.
I can edit this out later, mate. This is all good.
He was troubled. He was a troubled soul. So yeah. I enlisted as campaign manager in our quixotic tilt to take Jeff to task.
So you're going to run for a seat? Which seat?
Jeff's seat of Burwood, which was one of the safest Liberal seats in Victoria.
Running under what platform?
An independent platform, transparency, accountability, open government. This was a premier who'd done fantastic things for Victoria, getting the state moving economically after the doldrums of the 1990s.
And much loved and admired by people in the city, much loathed by people outside of the city.
By people outside of the city and people who believed that he was less than accountable, doing things like sacking the state's auditor general, sacking a whole bunch of local councils, removing judges. He behaved like a man on a mission.
He was an emperor.
He was.
He was self-proclaimed emperor. Yep.
1999 was a strange year in Victoria because everyone thought Jeff was going to win another election, his third election. But there was this subterranean, under-the-radar murmur of dissent, which grew into a bit of a roar. And we started up our campaign thinking we were going to get absolutely nailed and we might lose our deposit. But we have to do this. However, shortly into our campaign, we were advised by the State Electoral Commission that because Stephen had been living most recently in Sydney, he was ineligible to run against Jeff. This led to the long night of a tortured souls where we wondered what the hell we were going to do. Stephen decided to get it all out on a 40,000-word treatise, which we published on the internet under the catchy slogan, Jeff.com. This was the sort of word that was used for people who were at the wrong end of Jeff's pineapple during his period as Premier. Jeff.com grew like Topsy because he said things that previously people hadn't been allowed to say about Jeff or didn't know about Jeff. Mm.
And it was one of the great early, you know, political dissent online forums. You
it
know,
was, it was a cyber campaign
yeah.
that attracted a whole bunch of interest from the media that showed us that you can actually use a tiny little internet site to change the way people think about politics. And we don't claim it swung the election result, but there were ripples. Some of the information got out. In one famous interview, Jeff was confronted by the local top talkback host, John Fain, with the allegations we'd made on Jeff. And it was the Thursday, I think, before the election, and he stood there in the studio and said, I'm not going to say anything, I'm just going to sit here and drink my cup of tea. And there was about 20 seconds of dead air time. It went into Country Victoria and apparently played appallingly with the voters who were sick and tired of being ignored by Jeff's arrogant style of government.
Oh, fantastic.
A classic moment. We were thrilled
And that was a big upset election, of course. Everyone was shocked. Jeff lost. It came down to the wire. There was a...
it was a hung parliament, actually.
Yeah.
And only when the independents, there were three independents, decided to support Labor rather than Jeff, did Kennett fall.
Yeah.
And
there was a by-election. It all came down to a by-election in what? Dandenong? Frankston? I remember I ran into Jeff at the Arts Centre the night before the by-election. It was like a Friday night, right? And I was having a quick chat to him outside, and he looked worried. You know, you weren't used to seeing fear in the eyes of the great man, but fair enough, it was his last day, too. I didn't wash my hand for like 2 weeks after that.
It was. Well, he I'm sure he didn't either, Cameron. He came and went, but we thought, gee, there's something about this that's really catchy.
This is Jeff.com.
Jeff.com.
You were so surprised with the impact that it had, or pleased with the impact.
We were.
It parlayed into something.
But it was clear to us that we couldn't just... we had to have more than one string to our bow.
So how did your political campaign go in the end? You had to walk away when...
We walked away from that.
Stephen
wasn't eligible.
We
subsequently ran in... when Jeff stood down and retired from Parliament, we ran in his seat as an independent. Well, Stephen ran, and I ran the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a healthy 7.5% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we were quite... pleased, that's about our niche, I think.
Mm-hmm.
If we get 5 to 7% of people tuning into us as an internet site, we're doing fantastically.
Absolutely.
Subsequently, we rolled that into a more broad-based internet site called crikey.com.au.
Crikey. Why the name?
Crikey, we tossed around a few names.
So this is pre-Steve Irwin, too, really.
It was. Before Steve was had come out of his Queensland nature reserve and become a multi-media megastar, Crikey was an old... fashioned Australian, I think actually it's a New Zealand word.
Really?
Meaning amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
So we felt that probably captured the impact of what we were going to do.
It's like an Australian version of Yahoo.
Yes. Mini Yahoo. Slightly less corporatised Yahoo.
Yeah.
Crikey started on Valentine's Day 2000, just as the internet was starting to puncture.
Crumble, yeah.
And it was a brave venture in that sense, because better people than us with bigger pockets had, were just about to crumble and toss themselves out of windows. But in a sense, it was counterintuitive, and it worked because there was a low capital startup. There was $160,000 put into the venture startup. We had very low costs and outgoings. I mean, a few people working basically for love, not money. The platform, delivery platform, was very simple. We sent an email every day of the week out to our small but increasing band of subscribers.
Were you charging from day one?
Yes, there was a small fee. I think it was might have been $40, our first annual subscription fee.
And that's what impresses me the most about Crikey, I guess. That charging for content on the internet has never really been a winner.
It's very hard.
Yeah, and, you know, there's been a lot of big sites. You know, New York Times tried to charge for quite a few years, and there's a number of other properties like Slate, I think, that tried to charge. But, you know, Crikey's managed to pull off that charging model. Why do you think Crikey's been successful? Is it because of the calibre of the writing, the edginess of it over the years?
I'd like to think so. It's the product differentiation. It's a niche. I think the successful sites are going to be those that offer something different. Mm. The reason big newspapers, I don't think, are going to make a go out of charging for their subscriptions is that there's too much general information out there on the internet that's free. Lots of crap, but lots of good general information that's free. If you offer a point of difference, if you offer inside gossip about politics, the media and business, which is what Crikey offers, then you've got to go. The market's pretty small in Australia. There aren't enough people, and magazines devoted to politics have come and gone. There aren't enough people in Australia who pick up a magazine off a newsstand about politics, but there are just enough people who want to subscribe to an edgy sort of e-zine that offers them the kind of delivery that's easy. It jumps into their terminal about lunchtime every day. They know it's coming. They know what's they're going to get a little surprise, and it's a model I think that works on those levels. Niche. A little demand and word of mouth. I mean, the marketing has been purely word of mouth, very little marketing budget.
How many of the subscribers to Crikey do you think are vanity subscribers, people who expect to see their names in it each day?
Well, that's the way it started. I mean, you've got to give them what they want. We unfortunately, our first one of our first blunders was when our technical guru accidentally pasted in our subscribers in the CC button, and our very early subscriber list was then spammed by all number of folks and published in an industry journal. So we thought, oh, here we go. You know, people are going to drop off. There's a major breach of security. But fortunately, people understood we were a sort of a shonky startup.
Yeah.
And that was part of the rise.
Scrappy little startups can get away with a lot. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, we didn't have a corporate brand, so we didn't have a reputation to protect.
Yeah.
So we built that up. People forgave us. We've managed to keep that subscriber list reasonably confidential.
Yeah.
But now it's got to a stage where, yeah, people are pleased to announce their Crikey subscribers, whereas in the first year or so it was very much an underground operation.
And I've read numbers around about 5,300 type subscribers. I think they're the publicly stated numbers I've seen. And what do people pay for it now? $100?
$100
year?
$100 a year.
$100 a year.
That's
reasonable.
Yeah. So I mean, if you can get people to pay $100 a year, you're doing well.
You pay more than that for the age, really, don't you?
Much more.
Yeah.
So
three times that.
Well, I think about $290 or something like that for an annual broadsheet subscription.
Okay. And so it covers, Crikey, again, for people not in the country and for the people in the country who don't subscribe, obviously, it covers politics, business, a lot of AGMs have been routed over the years.
That was another clever little marketing technique. We went to annual general meetings of companies and kicked up a bit of a stink.
News Corp, I think, has got the fat end of your stick.
People like, we did a double team. Stephen took on Rupert Murdoch at his AGMs, which had never been done before. He always held them. This mighty News Corp always went to sleepy old Adelaide to do their AGMs. So everyone turned up in their sort of tweed and twin set and pearls and asked about two questions like, how's your health, Mr. Murdoch? And it's wonderful to see you again. And then they adjourned for afternoon tea. But then Crikey turned up and started asking tough questions to Rupert Murdoch. And all of a sudden, the media started publicising this shocking... I mean, it's how pathetic is it that the media hadn't bothered turning up to Rupert Murdoch's AGM to ask questions of the most powerful man in the world? But that's the way the media scene was in Australia. It was...
Was or is?
Oh, less so. I think there's much more accountability now, and I like to think that Crikey can take some credit for it, for shaking it up, for saying, look, this is a media duopoly. There's the Rupert Murdochs and the Kerry Packers, and you're not asking each other questions. It's a cartel type of town. So I went and asked questions to Kerry Packer and James Packer, the other big media barons in Australia. And funnily enough, and also people like Kerry Stokes at Channel 7, and funnily enough, we didn't get thrown out. We bought our shares. We stood up and asked questions. They were pertinent and relevant, we like to think, not too antagonistic. And after a sort of a sharp intake of breath, we had people like Kerry Packer standing up and saying, well, I'm glad you asked that question. You know, so... There's a lesson there, I think, for media types. Then is you can't ask too many questions in any forum. And I think a lot of media had been corralled by PR and by pretty low expectations. Nowadays, if you read the business sections of our newspapers, they're much more lively than they were 10 years ago. It's because, I think, of a more globalised attitude to reporting news. In all forums, people actually have access on the internet to what's happening in America and the US and Europe, so they demand more of their publications. And publications like Crikey have been able to stir it up a little bit. Whether Crikey will stir it up as much in the future is another question, because their business has been purchased, it's starting to mature. The new owners have new ideas about what they want to do, about how to build it, and that's their right. But that's where I parted company with Crikey. I was very much old Crikey. I refused to grow with a business, I think.
I was like that at Microsoft, mate. I was old Microsoft, and I had to leave when it became new Microsoft. So I'm with you. Power. Power to the rebels.
Mate. Power to the rebels.
So let me. The main question I had for you, Hugo, is I said before we went to air that, you know, I get a lot of crap from mainstream journalists. A lot of mainstream journalists, particularly in this country, really struggle with what's happening in the blogging and the podcasting space, even though I've been saying for 2 years, we are not... I don't consider myself a journalist. I'm married to one, that's enough. I don't want to be a journalist. I don't aspire to be a journalist. To me, blogging and podcasting is just people getting together and having a chat. You know, we're talking. Same thing we've always done in our... You know, over a coffee or over a beer, we just happen to be, you know, writing about it or recording it and putting it out there for other people to tune into today. But from somebody who's lived in mainstream journalism and then has lived for, you know, a good 5 or 6 years in the new media world... What do you think's happening with new media? What can you see happening over the next 5 to 10 years? Do you see any trends happening?
Oh, everyone talks about convergence. I think that what we're going to see is a greater splitting of the media industry. I like to think of it in a broad sense. The big media companies are going to try and increasingly get a slice of the action. They're getting smarter. If you turn your mind back 5 years... There were massive amounts of money being thrown into online ventures by the major media companies. You might remember something called F2, which was Fairfax's bold venture into online media and consisted of setting up a few websites and burning $70 million because they didn't understand you had to be nimble. You can't just transfer what you're doing in hard copy, in deadwood journalism, online. So you've got to be clever about it. If I knew what was happening in 5 years... online, I doubt I'd be sitting under a tree, you know, pondering my next career move. But I tell you what, it's going to be unexpected, whatever it is. And it's going to come from people who are nimble, people who've have had a little bit of experience online, but maybe springing from a different field. It will be, I think, demand and consumer-driven. It won't necessarily be top-down. So I think it's going to be jumpy. I'm hoping it's going to be edgy and different. I'm hoping it's going to be more democratic. I think inexorably, big media's understanding, much to their chagrin, that they can't dominate the agenda anymore. And the power of money is no longer the final arbiter of what we see, read and consume. So any person with his or her mouse can click onto pretty much anything they want and drive that agenda. If I'm being vague, it's because I really don't know what's going to happen any more than anyone who's smart enough to be clicking on and listening to Cameron talking. Would I like to be involved in it? Yeah. Do I think that younger people will be driving the agenda? Yeah. They're the people who are logging into
MySpaces.
Yeah. And people in pinstripe suits, they're the ones who are scared about it.
You know, there's this idea I heard about a year or two ago called the C generation, they're calling it, the content generation. That there's this, we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years, this rise of a generation of people, and it's not necessarily a chronological demographic either. It, you know, ranges from the elderly down to the, you know, the kids. But there's this breed of people who are prepared to produce their own content, text, audio, and now video increasingly. They have the tools, they have the technology, they have the desire to create, and they also have the desire to consume content created by their peers. We're seeing a massive explosion in the amount of content that is out there to consume. 30 million blogs, 30,000 podcasts, an increasing number of video podcasts that are coming out. Now, what I struggle with, and maybe you can help me understand this, is 5 years from now, when there's a million different things for me to watch, listen to, and read online, the majority of which are going to be free, some of which, like Crikey or Ricky Gervais's podcast, you're going to have to pay for to get, but a lot of it's going to be free. What is it that's going to keep people coming back to the same old media brands that they've been coming to for the last 100 years? Because I talk, when I give this sort of rant at various industry conferences, Mike Van Nieuwkerk from The Age and guys like that stand up and go, it's all about brand. We've got a brand, a trusted brand. People are loyal to the brand. I don't see that.
I don't think you can bang that drum and get away with it these days. Okay, you've got the residual. A brand is the residual of what you've done, in certainly in Fairfax's case, for the past 150 years. And they did it very well for many years.
But when there weren't a lot of options.
Exactly. If you sit on your laurels, you're going to get your ass kicked. Ultimately, it's about what you produce for people. And if people like what you produce, that's great. But if they see the same old boring stuff happening and you don't pay attention to what they want, your brand means stuff all. Brands come, brands go. Rome fell, and so can the strongest media companies.
I like, if you think about Crikey, Crikey didn't exist as a brand 6 years ago. Now, today, it might only have 5,500 subscribers, which to a paper like The Age is nothing, but I'd suggest, from what I read between the lines, that it's a very high-caliber subscription base. Not only is it a subscription base that's willing to pay, you know, a decent amount of money for what is a fairly low-cost operation, but it's a fairly powerful demographic that has been attracted to that. So within that political/business demographic out there, it does have very strong brand potential, but it didn't exist 5 or 6 years ago, right? So brands can come out of nowhere.
Absolutely.
In the media space.
Yeah, that's true. And the media space does amplify. I mean, a lot of that's word of mouth. None of that particularly was advertising.
Mm.
And we did a bit of viral marketing. Mm. But, you know, ultimately, it's about what you do. And the space is fantastic for that, because people who you're talking to will be attracted to what you're doing if you provide something interesting, fresh, and new.
Mm.
I don't know whether what Crikey's fortunes will be over the next 10 years, but I can say with confidence that there will be Crikey-style publications out there in 10 years. Mm. What form they take, I don't know.
Yep.
But people always want to talk about people.
Yeah.
Whether it's... And they want to talk about people in their sphere of influence.
Yep.
So maybe you'll get a Crikey that talks about... style publication that talks about other industries. It just so happens that this Crikey is focusing on media, politics, and business.
Have you been involved much in the blogging world? Have you been following what's happening with blogs?
Yeah, I have, and I'm amazed with the passion out there and the energy that bloggers have. I mean, there is... I think it's a classic C generation out there. I think that there is a thriving and amazing undercurrent of information. The subterranean blogging world will, I think, develop into a mainstream culture. It already is.
I was reading a blog by a mate of mine in Canada, Jeremy Wright, this morning. He was saying that the thing that scares him at the moment is MySpace. This whole MySpace thing, by I think by June, if its current growth rates continue, it'll be the largest website on the planet, largest trafficked website on the planet by about June this year.
Yep.
And this is all, you know, mostly kids and musicians creating this content for themselves and networking around each other's content.
Absolutely, and don't tell me that people like Google aren't trying to harness that. I mean, the big companies out there are doing whatever they can to try and keep tabs with and align themselves with bloggers because they realise that's an enormous future.
Mm.
Now, if Google's obsessed by trying to form a sort of a blog alliance, people should stand up and take notice. I note that there's a bit of anti-Google bias,
bit of backlash
news out there.
Yeah.
Both in the blogosphere and also the mainstream. Mm. So I think newspapers see that as a threat. Again, very active newspapers and old technology.
Mm.
But they're seeking to protect their patch when in fact they should be embracing it. It's the only way. You've got to embrace the future. There's no point standing up and, like King Canute, sandbagging yourself. You've got to make alliances and make them quick. It doesn't take a lot, by the way. Your average blogger would be thrilled to get an approach from a major newspaper or a major media group. I know bloggers who'd give their kidneys to be paid a little bit of money and a bit of attention, and great bloggers who aren't getting paid and are getting maybe a bit of click-through revenue.
Yep.
And there's a lot of them out there.
Speaking about blogging and politics, you know, obviously you've done a lot of work in the political sphere in the last 20 years in journalism. It strikes me that one of the big opportunities for Western society to... There's a lot of dissent, a lot of unrest at the moment. People are talking about politics for the first time in a long time. Your average people are starting to pay interest again. You know, I look at the films that are slated for Academy Awards this year. I think four out of the five, I think Brokeback Mountain's the only one that, or maybe Capote, three out of the five have a political theme to them and an antagonistic political theme. They're critical of America's foreign policies. Do you see that there are some opportunities left to create more diverse discussion in media around what's happening in politics?
Oh, yeah, especially since the essentially conservative mainstream media has ignored, especially, I could talk about Australia perhaps more than the States. The Australian media is fairly conservative when it comes to buying the line. If you take the very sophisticated attempts by George Clooney to get a little bit of discussion going and analogies with
good night,
Cold
good
War
luck.
America.
Yep.
Yes, in Goodbye and Goodnight. Good luck. In Australia, the media still pretty much buys the party line. You know, I'm interested in things like the branding of the war. We've gone from the war on terror to, God help us, the long war now. Who's deconstructing that? No one in the Australian media. I mean, but you have to go overseas to look at, maybe in Europe and some American publications to look at exactly what's happening in our foreign policy, and it affects every one of us. So, yeah, I think hopefully Australia will take that lead.
Now, I have this argument with my wife, who I said before is a former journalist all the time, about why the Australian media doesn't pick up some of these stories and really run with them until, you know, that they do deconstruct them in an effective way. If there is any coverage of some of these issues, they usually last one or two editions and then they're gone. And she gives me the line, well, you know, it's not really news. You know, if you talk about it once, you've talked about it and then you have to move on. There seems to me that at least the new media has an opportunity to have more of a persistent discussion around some of these themes.
Definitely, and to the point of obsession, I encourage it. I mean, I turned on the radio this morning, and this is the ABC, and one of the lead items was a bunch of meat workers in Nebraska who'd won the lottery. I mean, come on, that was the only news out of America today? I don't think so. So the mainstream, again, has got to watch out. It might think that it can set the agenda, but it won't be setting the agenda for long if people who are interested in politics say, I'm sick of this and I want to get some more detailed analysis.
Mm.
You know, it's out there. It's being discussed. It's just not being discussed very well in the serious press here in Australia.
And there's, you look at our government here, there's been... Jeez, in the last 5 or 6 years, so many scandals that just seem to have come and gone. They hit the headlines for a week and then they disappear, and there seems to be no follow-up, no analysis. What was the name of the guy, the ASIO guy, National Office of...
Well, there's been a few ASIO guys. He ran for the Greens.
Yeah.
And trying to remember his name.
I've read his book not long ago. But anyway, a guy like that. So, you know, he came out...
Name here.
Yeah, that's right. I will later. He came out pre the March 2003 invasion of Iraq, said, we know that there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He got vilified by the press, vilified by the government. Now that the official story is, oh yeah, they didn't have any WMD, how about that? We never knew. What a surprise. Where's the follow-up with guys like that? Where's the deconstruction of how he was vilified and by the press, by the
Sadly, we've got the goldfish memory span, and we've moved on to the next scandal. AWB, as it happens, and isn't it interesting that the same lines and same arguments, like
we didn't know,
being rehashed.
Yep.
And
no one told us.
Extraordinary that they get away with it.
Plausible deniability every time.
Whether there will be, and I don't think it's going to come from the mainstream press, but to draw an analogy, what happened in September 1999 with Jeff Kennett being unceremoniously booted out happened under the radar. Maybe it's, again, a case of the political change is happening under the radar, except the government doesn't know it. The opposition certainly doesn't know it. And we might find out on election day. I can't.
But, you
sense.
Know, but it's not a case of this party or that party.
Certainly not.
Beasley's out there saying, the leader of our federal opposition, oh, yes, we need to keep our troops in Afghanistan. He's toeing the same line, man. It's just different shades of grey.
Oh, there's no question that we've got wonderful homogeny here in Australia. So there's no product differentiation. I mean,
we need a new political party, Hugo.
Let's start one up right here under the tree.
I've got an idea for a political party. I want to run it past you because you know a bit about these things, right? Yeah. I'm going to call it the Terror Party, T-E-R-R-A. One World, One Political Party.
Beautiful.
It's a platform for the 18 to 40 generation. It's pro-legalisation of drugs. It's pro-choice. It's pro-technology. It's pro-environment. It's anti, religious fundamentalism. It's anti preemptive invasions of third world countries. It wants to keep a close eye on corporate malfeasance. It's what I call the common sense platform for the Gen X, Gen Y generation, who I think relatively sensible about such issues. And we go after we start it in Australia, and we go after just trying to win the balance of power. Get a couple of seats. Balance of power, get the kids to vote.
I tell you what, you might be fighting, it's a fantastic idea, you might be fighting toe-to-toe with people like Bob Brown there.
Well, Bob Brown strikes me as a bit of a waffler. I mean, guys like that, you know, they have some of the stuff right, but I don't hear him get up there and talk too much common sense. And we use blogs and podcasting, new media, to get our platform out there and to mobilise the kids to go vote.
Absolutely. With Bob, I think the problem is he's been captured by the party, in a sense. He tried to make some... I think before the last election, he was talking about common sense about Telstra, but the party then shut him up pretty quickly. So even sort of so-called broad-based parties like the Greens have their own machinery to stop too much free thought happening.
And I had Andrew Butland on the show 6 months ago. And, I mean, I've been reading Andrew's blog for the last year. And he writes a good blog. I mean, he comes across as a sensible guy in his, you know, late 30s, early 40s, whatever he is. But, you know, obviously they got no power left either, the Dems, so...
Well, I've got residual power in the Senate. And it's sad. I mean, crikey takes responsibility for helping destroy them during Natasha's reign. We published a whole bunch of bile, internal bile, which caused the party to basically self-destruct. And it's sad because they are probably the most have used the Senate and their seats in the Senate more intelligently than any party has since Federation. It just shows, unfortunately, that clever people don't always make clever decisions. The Terror Party, of course, will be different because it'll be a benevolent dictatorship.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm a big Napoleon fan, so, we're going to get in. No, you know, I just think that there's no party out there that speaks... I'm 35, right, so I'm not Gen Y, but there's no party out there that makes any sense to me today. None of them. None of them give me any sense of vision, you know, common sense platform. I don't hear any of them talking about the issues. And the ones that do seem to be, like, how many politicians in this country are effectively using blogging or podcasting to communicate with my generation? Bartlett uses his blog fairly well. Outside of him, Bob Brown's now doing a podcast.
Mm.
Those two guys. I mean,
yeah. Can you imagine Kim Beazley or John Howard doing it?
Exactly.
Come on.
The transparency. Where are the politicians? Hey, I would tell my other idea. Polly the Polly.
Oh, yeah.
Here's my other idea I had a couple of weeks ago. Steve Van Aperin, Melbourne boy who runs Australian Polygraph Services. I've been chatting to him about it. I want to start a campaign. This next round of elections.
This is going to sound interesting.
I want people to approach every currently sitting politician in their local electorate and ask them to sit a polygraph, a publicly funded polygraph around a standard set of policy-based questions. I don't care how many affairs you've had or whether or not you've snorted cocaine. In fact, if you've had a snort of cocaine, I'd probably think you at least were telling me the truth. Is that your mum?
There's my mum. Come over.
Hello, Hugo's mum. Come over, we won't. It's fine.
It's nice. Sit under a tree.
Hugo's mum's coming to join him in my little cafe.
We're waffling. Maureen, this is Cameron.
Hello, Maureen. Lovely to meet you. We're almost finished and I'll...
Pull up with you. No, you're just on time. It's a beautiful day and we're sitting under a tree with my mum. And it's the day started to pick up. We're talking politics and we've decided to form a political party. Cameron will be chairman, I'll be propaganda minister.
Exactly.
It's called the Terror
Goebbels.
Party. T-E-R-R-A.
And all of our cells will be called Terror Cells, I've decided to.
Absolutely.
Anyway, getting back to Polly the Polly. So I want every politician in the country to be approached and asked if they would be willing to sit a standard policy-based polygraph test before the next election. Now, I figure 99% of them are going to refuse, but we're going to put all of their responses up on the website.
Oh, yeah.
So you will be able to see, before you go and vote, which of your local candidates actually completely refuse to sit a polygraph because they know they're going to fail. The ones who do choose to sit it, we're going to video them and put a copy of their results up on the website, and so you'll be able to see how they respond to the polygraph test.
It's a fantastic idea.
Because we all figure our politicians are lying to us. Most of them are lying to us. I figure, well, let's find out. We have the technology. The polygraph, according to Steve Van Aperin, you know, if you know how to run a polygraph properly,
yep,
and you're a good questioner and you write the right set of questions, you can get a very accurate result. He reckons 98% accuracy. Let's make it happen.
We should get it funded in the budget. You know, the last budget gave $1 million to the Liberal Party and $1 million to the Labor Party for funding democracy globally. That's a $1 million slush fund they can spend however they like, basically, as long as they keep a few receipts. Would it be nice to have $1 million stay to the Australian Electoral Commission to fund polygraphs on an independent and bipartisan basis? All candidates can sit them.
Hmm.
And
choose to sit them? But they if they choose not to sit them, I want a record of the fact that my politician refused to sit a polygraph about policies and decisions.
These are the 15 questions we wanted to ask he or she. It's a brilliant idea.
Prime Minister, at the time when you committed Australian troops to Iraq, were you aware that there was significant evidence that Iraq no longer had a weapons of mass destruction program? I don't know what the questions should be, but you know what I'm saying. I'm not going to write the questions.
We can workshop them.
Well, we're going to do it publicly. I'm going to put them up on the website,
yep,
get people to suggest, analyse, critique the questions, get a set of 100 questions,
yep,
that we want every poly to sit for, then keep a public record of those that do, those that don't. I want to know. Before I vote for anybody in this next election, I want them to have successfully sat a polygraph test.
What do you reckon? You said 99% will say no. I'd
yep.
say 99% of sitting candidates would say no, and
yeah.
maybe 15 to 20% of challenging candidates would say, what the hell?
Exactly.
Nothing to lose.
Exactly. And I reckon the politicians who come into Parliament having sat a polygraph and know that it's going to be expected of them may conduct themselves a little bit differently over that term.
You might get a different kind of politician coming in too, ever since Howard and Latham conspired, and this was the best thing that happened during the last Parliament, to cut superannuation benefits quite drastically. So now politicians don't go in knowing that they'll get paid off the taxpayers' teat for life. They're actually not there for a sort of compensation scheme, but hopefully to get paid to do the right thing by their electors and certainly their party. So you get a combination of politicians who come in perhaps less for the money and more for the public service, and those who actually are honest enough to sit down and declare their beliefs under duress.
Or, you know, what they knew when they voted for certain bills.
What do you think of the latest outbreak of parliamentary democracy, the free vote, the conscience vote on RU486? Was it a positive, a negative, and what's your take out of it?
Yeah, and I think from a democratic perspective, conscience, every vote should be a conscience vote. I mean, voting along party lines doesn't do anything for me. But, you know, some interesting stuff came out of it. You know, there were some really interesting speeches from the floor, from the bit that I saw. Yeah, Costello's speech was very heartfelt, and he's not the kind of guy that you expect to see giving a heartfelt speech. You know, from John Howard's perspective, as I've said on my blog over the last few weeks, the man who is supposedly the leader of the party in the country, which stands for individual responsibility, saying that he doesn't believe women should have the choice of whether or not to carry a pregnancy determination clarified a lot of things in my mind. As a Liberal voter, somebody who's voted Liberal all my life, you know, I'm at a stage where I know I can't vote for the Federal Liberal Party anymore. It's lost its way as far as I'm concerned. If you're right and Jeff Kennett gets back into Victoria, though, I'll be voting for Jeff just because he's a lot of fun.
I think we're all voting for Jeff just for the fun value, at least. What about the interesting alliances that were formed on the floor and outside of Parliament? I mean, women getting together across party lines, that's got to be good, doesn't it?
I think so. I mean, I've got to be honest, I didn't follow it that level of detail, but, you know, I mean, to me, it's just an appalling state of affairs in the 21st century where we still even have to question whether or not the Therapeutic Goods Administration should have the right to administer a drug like this, or whether it should be in the hands of a single individual. I mean, just appalling.
Yeah. The one thing that emphasised for me was that an outbreak of democracy can really have a positive impact on the public debate. I think what could have been a squalid sort of brawl turned out to be quite intelligent and heartfelt, and reminded me a lot of the kind of Westminster debates that we still get even in the UK. Tony Blair has a huge majority, but the rollicking sort of cross-party issue-busting debates they have are much more superior to the sterile party lines that are drawn here in Australia.
Yeah.
And again, I think people are seeing that increasingly, not the mainstream people, but through the internet, people have access to a real vibrant democracy, a real vibrant parliament. Okay, you've still got inherent problems in the UK, but it's more alive, more interesting. And that's something I think to aspire to. I don't think they have polygraphs, so that'd be interesting too, to transport your polygraph idea to Westminster. I mean, this could be a huge franchise. I'm not sure if you should be spilling your guts on this quite yet, but I think it's a brilliant idea.
Well, I don't, you know, it's not something I want to profit from. I just want to see it out there. I think it's a healthy thing.
It's worth doing properly.
Yeah. I'm going to let you have breakfast with your mum, Hugo. Thanks for joining us. Good luck with the career and career choices from here on in.
Thanks very much, Cameron. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to your next move.
At the end of the First Crusade, the Church created a monastic military order known as the Knights Templar. Now, rising up from the ashes of history, they are the Vatican's last defense in the war between good and evil. Join us each week for a new episode in the Templar Chronicles podcast, where we're reading Heretic, the first book in the new dark fantasy series by International Horror Guild and Bram Stoker Award nominee Joan Assise. You can learn more information about the series at its official website, thetemplarchronicles.com, and get your weekly podcast right here on the Podcast Network.
Podcast Network. Real power can't be given.
It must be taken.